Well, I thought what we'd do is an interview, and then we'd each read some work. And we'll try and keep this to maybe about 70 minutes or so. I also thought maybe a Q&A would be good if people had questions. And I just have to say that I've been going over my interview archive, which goes back to 1990, really, and we got a grant to begin to catalog this archive. And I was going over interviews that I'd done with Andrew and other events that I'd done with Andrew, and I realized how influential he's been on me. From making sure you carry a pocket journal wherever you go if you're a poet, to writing American sentences, which I do every day and have since he helped remind me of that form in 2001, to writing about Haibun and many other ways. He's been a great influence. I didn't realize it until I started looking back at the past and in preparation for this event. And this book is fantastic, Tracks Along the Left Coast, and he has some copies of this available, and we'll get into the specifics. Here's what I wrote about D'Angelo. Born in Paris, Jaime D'Angelo was a cowboy, cattle rancher, medical doctor, psychologist, linguist, and poet. How many bios begin that way? A friend and colleague of Carl Jung, D.H. Lawrence, and Henry Miller, he corresponded with Ezra Pound, who called him the American Ovid, and was one of the most outstanding writers William Carlos Williams ever encountered. His linguistic and ethnographic work documented the languages of many Northern California Indian tribes, and he also homesteaded at Big Sur. What a life and what a task to document how this man's storytelling sits at the center of West Coast culture. So we'll get into the interview. You've been tracking him for a very long time, 40 years. Can you tell us about how he first crossed your radar screen?
Well, first of all, let me just say thanks everybody for coming out. It's great to be here in Port Townsend, and I appreciate the space and the introduction. Jaime D'Angelo. It actually took me close to 40 years to even begin to figure out how to pronounce his name. He does write in a letter to Ezra Pound late in life, An as in Analects, Goo as in Goo Goo Eyes, and Low as in Lowbrow. So Angulo. Somebody back in the 1970s handed me a copy of one of his books, a little Turtle Island publication called The Laureate. It was a novella. In the 1970s, Turtle Island Press, run by Bob and Eileen Callahan, were publishing some of Angulo's literary writings. He'd never had a book in his lifetime. He lived as, Paul, you mentioned, as a cowboy, a medical doctor, a linguist, an ethnographer, a poet, a novelist, several other careers in there, a homesteader, wilderness homesteader, and never had a book in his lifetime until 20-some years after his death, Turtle Island started to publish the Jaime D'Angelo Library, and they published seven little volumes and then eventually a reader, and somebody put one of those little volumes in my hand. And when I read it, I was knocked out, and I thought this is really the best account that I've seen of a kind of historical California, and in particular, the complexity of linguistics, ethnography, the deep cultural underpinnings of the Left Coast and the indigenous people and the wilderness. And so I began to read everything that I could of his, and tracked it for a very long time, always a little afraid that if somebody else didn't write a good book on him, I'd have to one day, and that's what happened.
In the book's introduction, you mentioned his influence on West Coast culture, and right away you get into Port Townsend connection with Del Moma Journal and Michael Daly, who's mentioned in the introduction, so maybe tying it into this local place and how that culture has come all the way up this way, or that influence on the culture, I should say.
Sure. It's interesting to think of Jaime D'Angelo's sort of reputation on the Left Coast as being really quite hidden from official culture in any way. his reputation, I think, stayed alive due to really a kind of backwoods underground. He was known to the beat writers, Gary Snyder, Allen Ginsberg, and Jack Kerouac. In fact, I'll challenge anybody to find the one sentence in a Jack Kerouac book where Jaime D'Angulo walks across the page for a moment. But after his death, he was seen, I think, as a kind of proto-bioregionalist. And I point out in the book that two journals specifically were named out of the influence of his work. The first was founded by Dale Pendel in Northern California in the Sierra Nevada foothills. He'd actually had an earlier journal when he lived in, closer to the coast in Siskiyou territory. And when he moved up to the kind of Nevada City area, he renamed his journal Kuksu after a culture hero figure that became the center of a major Native Californian sort of religious ceremony in the northern reaches of California. And that journal was founded, or really renamed Kuksu, in about 1973 or 1974. And Michael Daly and a couple of his friends, I'll be embarrassed if anybody is sitting in the audience who knows these people much better than me, but Jerry Gorsland and maybe Finn Wilcox and others, wanted to develop a bioregional sense for this district. And they decided to found a journal, and why they named it Dalmotma, I don't know. Dalmotma is the name of an Achamawi village sort of near Alturas in California, and they had plucked this out of Jaime D'Angulo's writings. There's a medicine song or a shamanic song that shows up in Angulo's Indian tales and several of his other writings that he probably got from possibly a Modoc woman, but maybe Achimawi. But his account of the song goes, I dig wild turnips at Dalmotma. I dig only rotten ones at Dalmotma. And that haiku-like as it is was actually a medicine song, and this particular doctor used it to call in one of her medicine powers. And for some reason, Michael Daly picked that up out of Angulo's book, Indians in Overalls, and they decided to use it as an expression of bioregionalism and to maybe extend the reach a little bit so they wouldn't be just completely local to Port Townsend, but would reach over to Dale Pendel and Gary Snyder and Steve Sanfield and Susan Sundry and other poets who were in Northern California and establish a kind of bioregional linkage there.
So this is what you talk about in the introduction. One of the first to bring into his life what I consider the primary characteristics of Pacific Coast culture, art, and scholarship. The encounter with wilderness, the search for primitive mind, a sharp investigation into what language is and how it works, a deep spiritual hunger, lonely, eccentric, keenly unorthodox, alert to Asian and Native California traditions, and anarchist, pacifist politics. And then a couple of pages later, you talk about a hunger for the origins of song, poetry, and the old forms of spiritual search, intimacy with one's bioregion, and a kin-centric worldview. Yeah, I guess that says it pretty well. I guess that's not a question, but that's basically the thesis of what we have here. Right? Can you talk a little bit about the places you went, the special collections libraries, and even visiting his Los Pesares to get a sense of who he was?
Sure. Yeah. I think actually I'm just curious. Quick show of hands. No shame here. How many people know of Jaime D'Angulo's work, have read some of it? So some people here, okay. I should say, you know, one of the things is, as Paul has characterized him, he really did a lot of things in his life and extended and reached out in many ways. Somebody once asked me, who in a nutshell was Jaime D'Angulo? And my sense was, you'd need an awfully big nutshell to fit this guy into. He was quite wild, and he really had quite a lot of directions he went. I think what he was and wanted to be and thought of himself as was really a top-rate linguist at a time when linguistics was not really a profession. He was an amateur linguist, but he had the reputation of having the best ear in the field. And this was at a time when Franz Boas and Alfred Kroeber and Edward Sapir and other linguist anthropologists were facing what they thought would be the extinction of most Native American, if not people, certainly cultural traditions and languages. And they needed people who could go out into the field and record languages.
Salvage was the word.
Salvage ethnography and salvage linguistics. And Dangulo turned out to really have the best ear, and without any real academic training or anything, turned himself into a great linguist and recorded approximately 30 languages, maybe 27, 28 Native California and Mexican languages, and then a couple of others he worked on, like Taos and Cantonese Chinese from San Francisco's Chinatown. His linguistic manuscripts, if you can picture this, there were rogue linguists like Jaime Dangulo, another one some of you may have heard of, John Peabody Harrington. There were also several students of Franz Boas and people, all these people going out into the field trying to record languages as fast as they could, faced with what they thought would be the extinction of many of these languages. In fact, that turned out to be true. Writing up the languages, by writing up meaning examining and sort of articulating their morphology, their grammar, their phonetics, getting something of a vocabulary list, and then shipping them back to Franz Boas, who is at Columbia University. Dangulo did a lot of work with his wife, Nancy, and Dangulo, Jaime and Nancy used to joke that all these manuscripts ended up in Boas's morgue. Boas's morgue is now held by the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. So I went there and looked through a lot of these, you know, manuscripts on Taos, on Shasta, on several on Achumawi or Pitt River, which was his really sort of pet language, the one he liked the best, and quite a few others. He did little autobiographies and things. So that would be one major place, would be the American Philosophical Society's holdings and the Boas collection. Angulo's own papers were deposited, some in UCLA, by his wife Nancy after his death, and then a lot more at UC Santa Cruz by Bob Callahan of Turtle Island, and eventually Angulo's daughter Guiomar. So these would be the three main archives. There are other places with material of his. But I just started to go hounding around in the Santa Cruz archives, and nobody else was doing it. They kept a little logbook, and I was the only visitor for 10 years to the Turtle Island archives until, you know, about 10 years after I started doing it, a California poet named Duncan McNaughton's name started to appear there also. But the archives are managed okay, but nobody has really described them. So it was a lot of fun to, you know, handle manuscripts and letters and logbooks for Los Pesares, the homestead at Big Sur, photographs, letters from all sorts of wild people, Marianne Moore, Edith Hamilton, Langston Hughes. I mean, he really had quite a lot of friends and comrades and people. And so, you know, this is sort of half my research, and then the other half was going places he'd gone to. This is known as the footprint principle. You go in the footprints of somebody. So Los Pesares, in particular, his homestead on Partington Ridge at Big Sur.
You describe that in the book. It's great. And looking at the place that was his house, how things have changed since then. I remember going to see Robinson Jeffers, you know, Jeffers planted trees all around, and you go up to Hawk Tower and you see, you know, all the development around there and this ring of trees going around. So you can imagine how Big Sur has changed since that time.
Yeah.
You talked about his ear. This is a guy who arrives in San Francisco. the day before the earthquake. And it is said he could, even though he didn't speak Chinese, could tell the difference between between Mandarin and Cantonese dialects.
Yeah, he, from early on, by the time he was in San Francisco as a teenager, he could go into a rooming house that was full of Spaniards and Italians and what they call Turks, who might be anything from Greeks to Persians to, you know, it's just a sort of generalized term. And he could almost immediately pick out villages that people came from in France and Spain, even though he hadn't been there in quite a while. He'd actually never visited Spain. He liked to think of himself as having Basque blood. He probably didn't. He sometimes told people he had Jewish blood. He probably didn't. But he had many, many characters and personalities. You mentioned Jeffers, though. I want to, you know, just tell an interesting anecdote. I assume some of you have read Robinson Jeffers and have a feel for him a little bit. They had a very close friendship that is still quite obscure to most people, but Angulo was living for a little while in Carmel, by the beach, you know, which is where Jeffers built Dorr House and his Hawk Tower. And the story is that Angulo was walking home from the butcher's up the beach with a couple of porterhouse steaks wrapped up in butcher paper under his arm, and he ran into Robinson and Una Jeffers, and they fell into conversation, and he invited them home. And Angulo at the time had two large greyhounds that he walked with. He must have cut quite a striking figure. And he and the two greyhounds and Robinson and Una Jeffers went back to the little bungalow that Angulo shared with his wife. And when they arrived, she was washing spinach. And Jaime said, "I've invited these people for dinner." And she said, "Oh, great. Una, you start the potatoes. Jaime, you cook the meat. And as for the spinach, washing it is more trouble than it's worth." So she threw it out the door. Jaime cooked up the steaks. The potatoes weren't ready. The four of them sat down, and suddenly Jaime's dogs were at the table, one on each side. And Jaime looked at the dogs, and then he looked at his guests, and he looked at the dogs again, and he said, "It'd be a shame if they went hungry." And he forked the steaks into the dog's mouth. So that was the friendship with Robinson Jeffers.
And in terms of an anthropologist, he wasn't considered a good one by the establishment because he was one who was prone to hanging out in the gutters, getting drunk with shamans.
Yes, that would be the the best story to tell, in a way. At a deeper level, he had been he spent a year as a cowboy up in Modoc County, which is in the far northeast of California, up on the Alturas Plateau there, and it's where the Pitt River Indians are. And after his year of being a cowboy, he then knocked around Carmel and eventually homesteaded at Big Sur. And when he finally decided he wanted to do linguistics work, he went back up to Alturas. And his accounts of it describe him going up and first being greeted by several Pitt River friends with, "Hey Doc, how you doing? Where have you been?" He was known as Doc or Buckaroo Doc because he had a medical degree. But he has a number of them saying things to him like, "Oh yes, I remember you. You're the white guy who would sit down and eat with us in the sagebrush. No other white man ever done that. You know, you gave me a can of beans. No white man ever done that." And Jack Folsom says, "Yeah, my wife remembers you. You're the only white man who would eat with an Indian." And so his ability to make friends with people and to move with people and not keep a kind of distance really marks his ethnography and his linguistics.
There's so many different angles that we can go with it, but I think that maybe we can cut to the chase and go to questions. But you, in the book, put his work on the level of Leaves of Grass or the Cantos.
Yeah, I could go on at length about this. This is a very tricky one. Angulo's best work was done in the last year of his life. The community radio, KPFA, the First Pacifica radio station in Berkeley, was founded that year. And within a couple of months, Angulo was asked to come on and do a regular program in sort of 10 to 15 minute segments. He did about 100 of them, and he called them Indian Tales. And for Indian Tales, he retrieved all the linguistic work he had done, all the Native American tales that he had heard, all the songs that he had heard. And when he ran out of his own material, he rifled through his wife's drawer and drew her work with Sierra Miwok and other Eastern Miwok tribes. And out of this 100 radio programs, if you listen to those, you will hear many languages that no longer exist. You will hear many songs that are no longer sung. You will hear many stories that have only been retained because of Angulo. You'll get all sorts of instruction and everything from skinning and curing an elk hide to how the Shasta whisper language works. This, I think, is his great work. The 100 segments were eventually edited by his daughter down into 88 segments, which were released first as cassettes by Pacifica Radio, then eventually digitized. His manuscripts were turned into the book Indian Tales, which is a very reduced version of the tapes. There have been some other publications that include others of his manuscripts from that. But what to do with the tapes themselves, and this is what I think is equal to Leaves of Grass or Pound's Cantos, except you can't read it, you have to listen to it. There are also manuscripts that go along with them, which are full of drawings and a kind of orthography for languages that are never spoken. And I just cannot ever imagine a publisher being willing to spend the money to reproduce these in some way. So in some ways, it's a great work of American literature that is almost impossible to get a whole sense of unless you put in years in the archives of KPFA Radio and Santa Cruz and UCLA.